The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Tonight, I'd like to especially welcome visitors from the School of Life YouTube channel. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce Alain de Botton. Exploring a philosophy of everyday life, he is the author of more than a dozen books that span fiction and nonfiction on subjects that range from religion to art to love, travel, architecture, and literature. He also founded and runs the School of Life, dedicated to a new vision of education on how to live well, the virtues to cling to, and the vices to be wary of. He last visited the Free Library in 2012 with Religion for Atheists, a practical and provocative argument that allows non-believers, in his words, to rescue some of what is beautiful, touching, and wise from all that seems no longer true. 20 years after the publication of his debut book, the best-selling novel On Love, he returns to fiction and to the love story with The Course of Love. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Alain de Botton.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to be here. I'm not going to talk directly about my novel. What I really want to do is to talk about some of the ideas behind the novel. And the novel is about love. So tonight is all about love. And it's going to be a personal, intimate sort of evening. We'll laugh. There may be tears, moments of reflection, and confession too. So it's all going to happen. Can I start by asking whether anyone in the room is married and happily married? Is anyone? Amazing. This is really astonishing, properly astonishing, because for most of human history, the idea that you would not just be married to someone, but in love with them, actually love them, was just considered absolutely peculiar. The point of marriage was not to love your partner. It was to unite your bit of land with their bit of land, your cow with their sheep, whatever it may be. The point is, it was a broadly dynastic and practical business. And the notion that you would, on top of everything, actually really think that your spouse was wonderful as a human, full human being, and respect and admire their soul, well, this just didn't really happen. It's only in the last 3 seconds, in evolutionary terms, that we have come to this new arrangement. And this new arrangement we call romanticism. You know, romanticism is the word that historians give to a movement which comes in the 19th century, and the point of romanticism is that it totally reinvented how we see love. And nowadays, even though we may not think of ourselves as romantics, we live in a culture that is profoundly romantic. And let's remember that we all love within a context. We love within a historical and social framework. You know, there's that lovely quote from La Rochefoucauld where he says, "There are some people who would never have fallen in love if they hadn't heard there was such a thing." And to some extent, we're all picking up cues from outside about how we should love. And those cues, in recent times, have all been romantic cues. So we are romantic lovers. So I want to just step back a little and just run through some of the key ideas that romanticism gives us about what love is like. So romanticism tells us that all of us have somewhere out there this very, very special person who we can call a soulmate. And we may not have met them already, but they exist definitely out there. You may have to swipe a lot and go on many dates, etc. But they're out there. And when you find your soulmate, well, it's just amazing. What happens is an end to all loneliness. All those broken, shy, vulnerable, misunderstood parts of you are at last endorsed by another person who can see you as you really want to be seen and acknowledge you in all your strengths and tolerate all your weaknesses. And in many ways, Romanticism had a very high idea of what human beings were like. You know, the older religious view sees human beings as essentially broken, in need of the mercy of God. If you're Augustinian, tainted by original sin, the sins of Adam. I speak to you as a secular Jew. The sins of Adam have... It's good to be at a pulpit, talk like this. The sins of Adam have tainted us all. But the point is, Romanticism had a very much more optimistic view. We are all of us like angels, without our wings, but with pure of heart, good, fundamentally good inside. So we're on the lookout for these very special, other, really good people. And when you find that click with the person you may call, without sarcasm or irony, an angel, when you find that click with your soulmate, your quest, your life's quest, is at an end. How are we going to find this very special person? Romanticism has an answer. Let's remember that for most of human history, people had what we call marriages of reason. In other words, the community, society would get together, and for logical reasons, may not have been good logical reasons, but anyway, reasons that you could account for in logical terms, would choose you a partner. Suddenly, this changes, and we enter the era of the marriage of feeling. In other words, marriages that are justified by someone having a really, really special feeling about someone. And you know how it is when you're in the mall, or you're on a train, or on an aeroplane, and you just see a very special person, you just get that feeling. And that feeling of being in love, becomes the centerpiece of what long-term relationships are meant to be based on. And so all of us, especially young people, are looking out for that special feeling. If you don't feel that special feeling, you might fake it, you might be a bit embarrassed about it, but you need it. And also, once you have that special feeling, no one can argue with it. You know, your parents can't go, why are you having that special feeling for that person? You know, you're not supposed to do that. That special feeling is like a kind of special anointment from above, and you do not question it. And so you just kind of go for it. Romanticism unleashed an era of crushes. You know, the crush may seem like an incidental and rather playful aspect of love, but for Romanticism, it's almost, if you like, the secret central sun around which the planets of Romanticism orbit. The crush is a very brief sighting of another human being which leaves you absolutely certain that they are the one. And in 19th century poetry and fiction, there are so many crushes. A lot of crushes happen on trains. 19th century is both the age of Romanticism and the development of the railways. And there are so many moments at which you're sitting in a carriage and you see somebody and maybe they're reading a book or something and you're just something perfect about them. Lots and lots of crushes, and on tiny details lead to a deep certainty. That's a very key thing. The other thing about Romanticism tells us that love is forever. When you fall in love with someone, it's forever. It doesn't have an end date. It's till death do us part. One should point out that for the Romantics, many of the Romantics died young and their partners died young. So, and indeed, weirdly, it was kind of poignant and almost, you know, romantic that the person who you thought you were going to spend another 50 years with dies so young of tuberculosis. And so you're getting together with the perfect person. They're so perfect, but then they succumb to tuberculosis. They're going to be out in a few months. But in those months, it's so intense and it's so tender. And death, indeed, is itself a romantic act. Lots of suicide in Romanticism. The shortening of life and the intensity of life is a great theme. Another thing about Romanticism is, about the Romantics is, not many of them had jobs. A lot of them were unemployed or had a stipend or family money or something. So that left them a lot of time to focus on love. And so they would spend a lot of time going for walks in the countryside. Going for a walk is a very key romantic thing to do, especially in summer, especially near waterfalls and oceans. Cliffs are very romantic places where the sea crashes into the rocks. And special times of day. Dusk is a very romantic time when the sunlight is just lighting up, shafts of golden light up the underside of the clouds, turning them a pinky hue. It's very romantic time. Now, another thing that Romanticism does is to reinvent what sex is all about. People have course, always had sex and they would always love. And sometimes the two went together, sometimes not. What romanticism does is to insist that sex become the crowning achievement of love, the crowning moment of love, and that you cannot have sex without love, and that love is, as it were, anointed by the sexual act. So sex becomes, in a way, a much, much more serious business. And the other thing that becomes much more serious is adultery, which becomes a tragedy. Adultery becomes a tragedy. In the 19th century novel, all the great 19th century novels, in one way or another, are about adultery. If you think of, you know, Gustave Flaubert's Madame Bovary or Tolstoy's Anna Karenina and on and on. Suddenly, adultery moves from being deeply unpleasant and a problem to being a tragedy, something you may kill yourself over because sex is so intimately tied to emotions. And this is a new thing. And we are the heirs of this host of ideas. These ideas that seem in a way like common sense, I'm deliberately slightly trying to take you to 30,000 feet over them. They're quite bizarre. They've not necessarily always been around. And I want to argue that even though in many ways these ideas are beautiful and lovely and touching and exciting, they are also trouble. They are big trouble. I want to argue that our relationships are in trouble partly because of this ideology of romanticism, which has wreaked havoc on our chances of having successful long-term relationships. Why? Why? This sounds rather cynical. I'm not cynical. I'm on the side of love. But I'm on the side of love in a way that discounts some of the reasons that romanticism gives us for why relationships should be the way they are. So let me point out some of the ways in which I think romanticism has ruined love. Well, one of the things that romanticism does is to insist that two people who get together are very pure and good. The truth is about all of us, well, you're all crazy, and I'm crazy too. Everyone is very seriously demented. We human beings are only just holding it together. We are quite fragile. We're very, very unable to understand ourselves. It normally takes, you've got to be at least over 45 before you begin to understand basic things about yourself. We can't regulate our moods. We can't understand where our moods are coming from. We're very bad at communicating these moods. We're real trouble to be around. And the thing is, not just we're crazy, but anyone we're likely to get together with is also going to be crazy. And, you know, when you have a crush on someone and they look so amazing at the supermarket aisles or in the train, maybe they have some lovely sides. Don't get me wrong. People do have lovely sides. But they also have something that we tend to forget, which is difficult sides. Everyone that you're likely to get together with, everyone, is going to be serious trouble from close up. Okay, it's just a rule of life. You don't know what the specific nature of the trouble will be, but it absolutely is going to be there, and it's just going to take time for you to find out. Why do we have such a hard time accepting this about ourselves? You know, many of us feel, I don't know if there's any single people here, young single people in their 20s are particularly guilty of this. I was one of them myself once, and the feeling goes like this. You think, look, broadly speaking, I'm quite an easygoing person, broadly speaking. And if I was just with the right person, it'd be amazing. And so it's just a problem of finding that right person. But broadly speaking, I'm okay. Now, I think if you think that you are an easy person to live with, okay, you don't know yourself. Everybody is extremely hard to live with. Why? It's just an extremely hard thing to do to live with anyone. All of us are so peculiar in our quirks. It starts with what time of day we want to get up, to what our moods does, to how we behave when we're angry, to how we behave when we're trying to get close to someone, on and on and on. And the problem is that we don't really know this enough about ourselves. We're not aware enough of how disturbed we are. Why are we not aware of this? Well, basically because we're surrounded by a bubble of sentimentality. Our parents don't really want to tell us. Maybe they don't even want to see it. So they're not going to tell us the truth about ourselves. Our friends, well, they're not going to tell us. Why would they tell? Why would they bother with the arduous task? They know all sorts of things about how crazy we are, but then they just want a nice evening with us occasionally. They're not going to go into the byways of our characters. And meanwhile, there are our exes. And our exes, well, they did have glimpses. And that time they said, you know, I want to spend more time on my own, etc. It wasn't quite that, but that was a nice way of putting it. They couldn't be bothered either. So you are left in blissful ignorance because simply a collection of people have never bothered to tell you how it is that you are real trouble. So we enter relationships very unaware of who we are. Now, in a better society, if I was running the world, all of, you know, a very typical dinner date question when you sit down for dinner with people would be, so I'm crazy like this, how are you crazy? And two people would just exchange notes on their relative craziness. And this wouldn't be seen as an insult. It's not like I'm perfect, how are you perfect? You know, I mean, two people go, I'm very special and perfect, and I'm very special and perfect too. You know these are two people in trouble. You know, one of the real enemies of successful relationships is self-righteousness. And self-righteousness stems from a feeling that you're basically a really good person. And, you know, you're one of the good guys. So what's going on? Why are other people causing trouble? You know, that's a problem. That's dangerous. Much better to go in with an Augustinian spirit. I'm broken. I'm sinful. I'm one of the sons of Adam, tainted by original sin. How are you? That's a good way. That's a good way of getting into a relationship because, you know, you'll be humble. You'll be a little humbler. Now, let's think about how people get together. So romanticism, remember, is in rebellion against the marriage of reason. And it says that instinct will lead you to the right person. And that's why never mess with instinct. Never ask, never question instinct. Instinct is this quasi-divine force leading us to the right person. Oh, yeah? Really? Okay. Now, here we have to go to the psychotherapists. Now, you don't necessarily have to be paid up Freudian, etc. Just the loosest acceptance of some of the basic tenets of psychotherapy will tell you that we learn to love not when we're young teenagers dating for the first time, but when we're children. It's when we are little children that we learn about love. It's in the family that we learn about love. And, you know, many parents are extremely full of goodwill, but they are likely to have mixed their love with some slightly troubling dynamics. Maybe they were a little bit anxious as parents. So when they loved you in a way, but there was a lot of anxiety around, or they were quite controlling, or they were a little depressed, so you needed to cheer them up all the time. Or they would get very close and then withdraw, or they died when you were quite young. Whatever it happens to be, there is likely to have been mixed in with our experience of earliest love a set of criteria which were less than optimal, and which indeed militate against our chances of full happiness. So the thing is, we grow up as adults, and we're not free to fall in love with just anyone. You know, we know in the physical realm that people will say things like, they have to be blonde, or they can't be short, or they've got to be like this, or they must be fat, or whatever it is. We have criteria. But we also have not just physical criteria, but psychological criteria. And these, most of the time, we don't really understand them, but they're fascinating. And they tell us, if we only we were slightly more expert in our own psyches, we would start to unpick them. But we sense them when we set friends up on dates. You know, imagine when you're setting up a friend and you go, you know, you should really get together with, you know, my friend because, you know, on paper, you guys are fantastic. So these two people go off and they have a dinner date and on paper, they're so compatible, etc. And then one of them comes back and he says, how was it? And they go, yeah, you know, that's so nice, but nah, you know, they just didn't have that feeling, that special feeling. And you go, whoa, what was wrong? And they go, well, yeah, really, they were really nice and maybe a little boring in some way, etc. Now, words like nice and boring are really fascinating because sometimes we discount people on the dating scene, not because they are nice and a little boring, not really that at all, but because they are not going to enable us to suffer in ways which we're quite used to. We need to suffer, some of us, in very particular ways. And there's a little unconscious bit of our brain. As we're assessing a partner, we go, nah, you're not going to make me unhappy in the way that I expect to be made unhappy. You're not going to re-evoke that special feeling I had when I was three, when mum was kind of down and I needed to be the joker, or when I was, you know, when dad was a little distant. I'm not getting that from you. You seem really reliable. No, I think I'm, yeah, too nice, you know, bit boring. That's the pleasant psychological blocking explanation for these things. So, in other words, look, our instincts are trouble. Our instincts are not reliable because they are the legacy of a complex history of love which was bound up with some really troublesome dynamics. This the romantics don't quite tell us about. Look, there's other things that are problematic in romanticism. The experience of love at the beginning is very bound up with honesty. And some of the most touching moments in early love are to do with being able at last to say things that you've not been able to say to other people. You meet at the office, let's say, and, you know, suddenly you're in a relationship and you're able to say all those things. You know that guy who does IT? Yeah, I hate him. You hate him too? Yeah, we both hate him. And the boss, we hate him too. And do you feel that way about the conference? Yeah, I feel the same way. And so suddenly you've got a lot in common. And then... sorry, don't want to be shocking, but a lot of this goes on around sex as well. So, you know, you're intimate with someone and you go, you know, I've always, sorry to embarrass you, you know, I've always wanted to do that thing. And they go, really? I've wanted to do that thing as well. I just didn't know it was allowed. And you go, yeah, sure. So you start doing that thing and it's just so amazing. And you feel like, you know, the whole world, which was previously alien, has now kind of been humanized through the prism of this very special person. And you feel no longer have to hide who you are. And it's one of the most exciting things about love, no longer needing to hide who you are. And all the things that you were so afraid were weird and unacceptable, etc., the other person seems to understand and accept. But then, normally about 3 months into a relationship, you've tried everything, the rope, the tying, the thing, the extreme thing. And then, let's say you're in a restaurant and... like you see a waiter and you go, you know, the thing is, you know what, wouldn't it be amazing, like, if we invited them and they kind of joined us and we did this kind of thing whereby they would be watching and you'd be there and I'd be there, and you just kind of look back at your partner and they're looking pretty ashen-faced and looking rather shocked and horrified, and you go, what, I realize suddenly there's a fork in the road. One fork leads to the path of total honesty. The other fork leads to the path of love. What are you going to pick? You're going to pick. Most of us end up picking the path of love because we don't want to hurt our partner. And we learn something that the romantics are not so good at reminding us is okay and is indeed an inevitable part of love, which is that in order to maintain any relationship, you have to lie. Not in the name of ending the relationship or of deceiving your partner for any sinister ends, but in the name of love. To expose someone to everything that you are is not something we should ever do to someone we claim to have good intentions towards. Being yourself is something you should spare anyone you love. It's trouble. It's difficult. So, in a way, an editing of yourself belongs to love. To edit yourself is not a betrayal of love. It is a loyalty to love. But again, romanticism doesn't remind us of this. It frightens us into thinking that something has gone wrong if we're having to do quite a bit of editing in various ways. It's worth mentioning another thing about the Romantics. So the Romantics were not really into practicalities. No one, I've never read, please correct me if anyone knows it, in, say, the whole history of the 19th century, I've never read any Romantic piece of literature that talks about laundry. It's just like no one ever does the laundry. It's just that never happens. In a poem, epic poem, novels, novella, nothing. Right? No one's ever done the laundry throughout 100 years. And indeed, there are many, many things which are immediately considered unromantic if you get interested in them. So if you went on an early date and you started talking about your dishwasher or the cutlery drawer, and you said, you know, I'm really interested in how, like, the knives and the forks go to... the people would immediately go, that's really unromantic. My God, that's pretty unromantic. Now, the thing about relationships is that actually they involve an awful lot of practicalities. But romanticism locates practicalities in a distant corner. It doesn't want to give them status. It indeed sees them as a betrayal of what love is to be about. And this leads us to tremendous difficulties when we get into relationships and find that we are hampered by all kinds of practical hurdles and difficulties and squabbles. You know, in the 19th century, there's one, in Madame Bovary, in Flaubert's Madame Bovary, Emma Bovary, who's married a, you know, very nice, slightly dull, but, you know, fine, ordinary, mortal, she's absolutely panicked the day that she realizes that her marriage is going to be a lot about ordering cheese. She's got to order cheese and milk quite a lot. So every day she's got to tell the maid about ordering things. And she thinks my life has gone wrong. She thinks my life is a disaster because she's read novels about what love is supposed to be about. And she's expecting guys on horseback, aristocrats, castles, castles in the mist, etc., all these things. And in instead, she's just sitting with her husband ordering milk and cheese. And she thinks, well, my life has gone wrong. And she destroys herself, eventually commits suicide. It's a total disaster because she's read the wrong novels. Ladies and gentlemen, I wrote a novel partly to save you because many of our ideas on love come from novels. And most novels give us a really strange view of love. There's not enough laundry. There's not enough practicalities. And so, you know, when we end up, it particularly afflicts intelligent people like you. Very intelligent people are particularly averse to practicalities because they look at their parents and grandparents and they thought, oh, these guys were really boring. They didn't really know about life. We're kind of modern and cool and know about things. And so we're not going to spend all our time kind of arguing about who cleans the car or who takes out the garbage, etc. That's just for stupid people. So then they get into a relationship, and then after a little while, they're faced with the towel incident. And the towel incident goes like this. Someone has a towel on the floor. Someone hangs the towel, and one person thinks that the towel on the floor is a sign of moral decay and decadence, and the one who hangs it up thinks that the hung towel is a symbol of righteousness and dignity. And they go at it, and at first it starts quite gently. Please, will you hang up the towel? And the other goes, no, it's just fine. It's fine where it is. I'll pick it up later, maybe. No, please hang up the towel, please. And anyway, and both people are convinced that this is a completely stupid thing to have an argument about. I mean, really, please, you know, one of us went to the Ivy League, the other of us got a PhD. We're not going to argue about this. This is absolutely crazy. You know that an argument is going to get bitter the moment that two people are convinced it's a stupid thing to have an argument about. And unfortunately, romanticism tells us that an awful lot of things are stupid to have arguments about. Ladies and gentlemen, there is nothing too stupid to have an argument about. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Everything is a worthy point of argument. And, you know, a lot of frustration is to do with how much time we budget. I mean, you know, the people who are inventing electric cars, they know it's very difficult. So they spend a lot of time. And when it goes wrong after a while, they don't just fling everything down and go, I'm giving up now. I'm going to get divorced from the project. Because they know they've got at least, you know, 7 years of kind of fiddling through all the thing. When you know a project is hard, and it is hard, you don't panic. When you think a project is easy and it's hard, then you panic. And many of us feel, because of the ideology of romanticism, that certain things do not belong to legitimate difficulty, whereas they do, and we're not properly prepared. Let me talk for a moment about sulks, because the other thing, romanticism created an epidemic of sulking in the modern world. Sulks are really interesting. What is a sulk? Okay, so a sulk is interesting because what a sulk essentially is a feeling of deep upset with a lover, sulk in love, deep upset with a lover for the fact they haven't understood you about something that you are refusing to explain. You do not want to explain. And why don't you want to explain? Well, you don't want to. You could explain, in theory, you explain yourself to lots of people. You're not going to explain yourself to your lover, absolutely not, because they should love you. And if they love you, they should know. They should know. Just they should know, so you're not going to say. You should know. So when you get home after that squabble, you're just going to go into the bathroom, you're going to lock the door, and you're not going to say. And they're going to say, please, just open the door, come on. And you know, because you want them to read your soul through the bathroom door into your soul to understand who you are, and you're not going to explain. Romanticism believes that two people should be able to intuitively understand who each other is. That you know, words have a curiously low status within romanticism. I wonder, does anyone here think that by thinking too much, you can break or damage feelings? Does anyone think that by thinking too much, you can sort of break? Yeah, a few people. That's a classic romantic idea. I like you. Don't worry. It's fine. But it's a very classic idea. And it's really the idea that feelings exist here and reason exists here. And if you submit feelings to reason, you're ruining them in some way. And that extends into love, where if you spend too long having to spell everything out, something kind of a bit wrong, you should be able to understand people intuitively. And that's why one of the most romantic things to say in the early days of love is you're reporting on a love affair to a friend. You say, you know, it was amazing. We hardly needed to speak. We understood each other. You want to go, really? Wow, how long is that going to go on for? And is that a good idea? An alarm bell immediately. Look, I am a writer, so I'm very invested in the idea of actually spelling things out. But the point is, it is a very legitimate concern. Despite some early stunning examples of soul reading, your partner cannot read your soul. They can't do it, and nor should they be expected to ever. We have to give accounts of what's going on inside us to our partners. But again, romanticism dissuades us from this task and makes it seem like a betrayal. No, we have to have rather artificial-sounding conversations in which the strange things inside me can have a chance of being understood by you. And that's going to require an awful lot, of artificiality, if you put it that way. But artificiality in the name of love, in the name of the continuance of love. It's not a betrayal of love. Look, something else that happens in love is criticism. You know, when you first get together with somebody, one of the most exciting things in the early days of love is the feeling that everything about you is just accepted and is really quite delightful. Even things that you considered maybe quite embarrassing about you, the lover thinks kind of charming. So you tell them, you know, I've got this gap between my front teeth, and they go, oh, that's so cute. I love it. It's kind of gawky, but geeky, but sweet. And, you know, or you go, I'm quite shy at parties. And they go, oh, don't worry. That's all right. Come with me. I'll introduce you to people, etc. So even little vulnerabilities, or these are my old pajamas. I know they're not that great, but, you know, I feel cozy in them. And they go, oh, that's so nice. So you accept a lot of things that could be considered weaknesses or problems. That has a very nice, it's part of what makes early love just so beautiful. It can't continue. And nor should it. And it normally comes to a screeching halt over the cereal moment. It's early morning, you're having cereal, and just kind of listening out, and you're thinking, they sound like a cow. They are chewing this cereal. They sound, I'm having breakfast with a cow. It's just, it's disgusting. I can't bear. So you just clear your throat. I'm really sorry. And you're a little tired, and you could find a better way of putting it. You just go, you sound like a cow. And they go, what? And you go, yeah, it's just chewing. Don't eat like that, right? And they go, no one's ever told me that I eat in this way. And you want to go, well, of course they haven't. Why would they? Why would they bother? Your parents wouldn't bother. Your exes wouldn't bother. But, you know, but the point is, it's a legitimate thing to try and point out. But we have this idea, very strong idea, if you loved me, you wouldn't criticize me. That's the strongest idea, romantic idea. To love is not to criticize, right? True love, you know, and very often people say in these heated moments, they say things like, well, my mother accepts the whole of me, why can't you? What is it about you that means that you're constantly trying to criticize me? Ladies and gentlemen, there's an alternative to romantic love. It was invented by the ancient Greeks, and it can really help us out over the cereal incident. It goes like this. The ancient Greeks believed that love is not an endorsement of everything about another person. What love really involves is admiration for what is good in another person. And the feeling of love is a feeling of respect for accomplishment, virtue, and beauty. In a way, perfection. When you encounter perfection in another person in a given area, that's when you feel love. You might feel other things towards someone's flaws, tenderness, sympathy, patience, all sorts of kind of other things, other quite nice things, but you don't feel love. Love is about perfection. Love is about accomplishment. You don't love what is imperfect. And for the ancient Greeks, relationships are essentially processes of education. They are educational institutions. And both the lover and the loved one are teacher and pupil in a constant rotation. And it is not a departure of love to try and teach your partner. Indeed, the point of love is to try and guide your partner to be the best version of themselves. And far from being a betrayal of love, it's an honouring of love's deepest promise to point stuff out. So we should be teachers and we should be students within the classroom of love. Now, why aren't we? Why is this so difficult? So partly because we love against the backdrop of romanticism that sees all criticism or feedback as a betrayal of love. That doesn't help. And that means that when we're in the teaching role, we're likely, you know, what makes a good teacher? A good teacher is calm. Very important. First rule of teaching, you're calm. And you're calm in part because you don't really care that much. You know, if the student body, if they're not going to understand trigonometry, well, it doesn't matter, it's their problem. You have another class next year, etc. You're very calm. You don't really care about the outcome. You're doing your best, but you don't really care about the outcome. Why can't we do this in love? Partly because we are so invested. So the reason why we lose our tempers and lose our calm over, say, the breakfast cereal moment is because we're thinking at the back of our minds, my life's a disaster. If this person does not understand this lesson, I've married an idiot and I've ruined my life. So in other words, at the background is not, it'll be fine, it'll be okay. The thought is, I've ruined my life. So of course you're not going to be calm. You're going to be more or less hysterical. And even though you wanted to take the person, you know, HR tells us that if you want to try and feed something back to somebody, it's got to be 99% honey, great calm, and a tiny little criticism. You know, on the one hand, might I just point out one tiny thing? Instead of which you're going, you stupid idiot, you sound like a bovine creature. Right? It's by the time you're talking like this, you've lost your audience entirely. You know, humiliation is unfortunately never a route to education. Once you start to humiliate someone, you've lost them. And unfortunately, because we're so scared, because we're so, not because we're bad, but because we're so scared, we tend to deliver our lessons in love in very, very harsh terms. Meanwhile, our so-called student doesn't want to be a student. They think, who are you? My teacher or something? They cross their arm. What are you? You're going to give me a lesson in love? Right? They're angry. They don't want to hear a lesson. And they're remembering their mother who accepted everything about them. So they're kind of furious. So then the couple, love's classroom, collapses in bitterness and silence. And what you get instead is nagging and shirking. What a nagging and shirking. Well, the nagger's given up teaching. The nagger has given up trying to persuade through reason and logic and patience, and they simply want to insist. Take the garbage out now. Stop eating like this. Do it like this. And you don't even want to explain why, because it's so painful to explain why. You just try and force the person to do what you want. And the other, it's always accompanied by its yang, which is shirking, which is the other person just goes, no, and goes upstairs and reads the paper. So they're not listening, and you're insisting, and Love's Classroom is entirely broken down, partly because of an ideology developed largely in Germany and Britain, and to some extent France, in the late 18th and early 19th century, called Romanticism. So that is what makes our lives so difficult. Well, look, is there any answer? Yes, of course, there are lots of answers. Look, I should start by saying marriage and long-term relationships, well, let's think on marriage. Marriage is a really difficult, almost cruel thing to do to someone you claim to love, because it's really, it's so tricky. But nevertheless, I don't want to advocate a diet of low expectations. I'm not saying, you know, it's great that we have the high expectations we have. The thing is that we've got the expectations here and we've not built the scaffolding to reach them reliably, because all we've left ourselves is instinct and half-baked notions of just going with our feelings. I mean, so many other things in life are difficult and we do not allow instinct to guide us. If I said, you know, I'm landing a 777 tomorrow, I've not done any aeronautical training, I've just got a really good instinct about how it's going to work. You'd think, oh my God, or I'm going to perform a minor surgical procedure through instinct. You think this man's crazy. We're ready to accept a classroom and its importance in many areas. Oddly, we resist it in love, and the results are everywhere to see in the extraordinary number of failed relationships that surround us. I don't believe that love is a feeling. Love is a skill, and it's a skill we've got to learn, often through patience, through mistakes, etc. Now, what might we be learning in love's true classroom? So one of the things to learn... Here's one lesson that I found very, very useful. Let me try it out on you. It's very helpful when dealing with your partner to imagine that even though they look like an adult, they're in fact about 3 years old inside. The partner as child theory, you might call it. It's terribly helpful. The thing is that when it comes to dealing with children, we're so generous in our interpretation of what might be going on behind behavior which isn't that optimal. So if you cooked your three-year-old some dinner, made a schnitzel, some potatoes, et cetera, you put it down, and they're sitting down with you, and then they just swipe it off the floor and go, nah, right? You don't hit them and go, what are you trying to do to me? Hurt me? Do you know I've been at the office all day? What are you trying to try and ruin my life? You don't say that. You think, oh, well, maybe he didn't sleep well enough, or but perhaps he's got a sore gum, or maybe he is a bit jealous about his younger sister. It can't be easy to be dethroned like that. And so... in other words, we really extend sympathetic explanations. We go 360 degrees around a piece of difficult behavior in order to try and find something to attenuate an otherwise harsh interpretation. Do we do this with adults? No, absolutely not. We go, you know, you're trying to hurt me. What are you trying to do? Bring me down, ruin my life, etc. We don't extend this kind of generosity. We're so aware We're so aware that it's patronizing to treat someone as younger than they in fact are, that we're not alive sufficiently to the idea that it's sometimes the height of generosity to treat someone as maybe younger than they seem, in order to extend, as I say, this generosity of interpretation. You know, all of us are, as I say, quite broken, quite difficult, quite wounded. The problem is you can't see it often. You can't see our wounds. If I had a very badly broken arm and a big cast and a sling or something, people would treat me a little bit more nicely. They go, oh, well, you know, doesn't matter about the bad speech. He's got an arm in a sling. You know, no wonder. And then someone would open the door for the guy. And, you know, you're just a little more, you go easy. You go easy when you see somebody with a wound. The problem is that all of us are really wounded inside, but you can't see it. So we look, part of our problem is that we look kind of normal. You know, you look normal, I look normal, and we look kind of adult as well. We don't look three. The really big problem of adult life is we look adult, and yet we're not, in large part. And so that requires an awful lot of work of the imagination to decode, to translate, to take what seemed like one thing and to see that it's in fact another. You know, this is again what psychotherapists are very keen on. One of the things, it's very hard to try and get close to someone that you're in a relationship with, when you fear rejection. And we sometimes think that rejection is just something that happens at the beginning of a relationship, but actually there's a constant and ongoing fear of rejection. So imagine somebody comes home and their partner, just a little subdued, they just go, hi, hi. And the partner goes, oh, hi. And suddenly some little trigger is pressed in their minds and they go, the partner doesn't want me. So instead of going, oh, I was a little struck by how you were a little distant and cold and, well, I want to be close to you I'm a little hurt, but you know, not too bad. I just want to share that across. Instead, you go, well, I'm just going to go upstairs. I'm going to do something on the computer. I'll see you later. Bye. Right? And in other words, you suddenly get quite brutal and they go, oh, you seem a little cold. And you go, no, I'm not cold. I just don't want to see you tonight. And actually, if you decode all that, really it is, I really want to see you, but I'm afraid that maybe you don't want to see me. And I'm quite vulnerable in front of you because I've kind of given over my life to you. And that's hard to remind you because we're supposed to be married and we've got a mortgage, etc. And yet I find it quite hard to say that I want to touch you. And sometimes I think that you don't want to touch me. And instead that comes out as, you're a bit of a shit, you know, I'm going upstairs. So it's a real headache. And we need to do that work of decoding and translation. Look, another thing we really must try and do in love is it's so easy to think your partner is an idiot. It's really important to see that they're not an idiot, they are a lovable idiot. And in order to see them that way, we need that quality which you need more than anything else in a relationship, which is humor, comedy. Think of someone like Larry David, right? If Larry David was in your life, you just think the guy is such a jerk. He's such an idiot, right? But why don't we think that? Because he comes presented to us with the beautiful envelope of comedy. And so even though he's a complete jerk, we kind of love him too. He's a lovable idiot. That is the work of comedy. And even if we don't have Larry David's genius, we must try and do that with our own partners, to look at them through the eyes of humorous love. Look, I think that many of us feel that getting into a relationship and making a relationship work is just instinct. It isn't. There are many criteria, boxes you have to tick before you're ready for love. I think, just to sum up, I think you're ready for love when you're fully aware that you are completely crazy, when you're fully aware that anyone you're likely to get together with is crazy as well, when you realize that anyone that you see in the supermarket or online or on Tinder, etc., that anyone, even they look absolutely lovely, they will be crazy too, and quite a lot of trouble too, so don't run off, and that life, a life together with somebody is going to involve a lot of laundry and some arguments about towels. It's not the end of love, it is what love requires, and that you'll constantly be needing to apply humor and generosity of interpretation. If you can do at least some of those things, then you are ready for love. Otherwise, take a pause, read my book, and then we'll talk again. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Now we... We've got a little time. We've got a little time for questions, thoughts, confessions, tears. Don't feel embarrassed. We're among friends. So if anyone has got any thoughts.
So before I ask you the question I want to ask, could you just explain to me, I've read many of your books, how do you pronounce your last name?
That's a really important question. Yeah. I'll start with the first name, which is Alain, and the surname is De Botton. And it's a troubling name that's originally a Spanish name. It's a Sephardic name. So there was once somewhere in the Iberian Peninsula a place called Botton, and then it got a De, and, you know, that's it. So I'm not a French aristocrat, unfortunately, and I've just got this weird name. So thank you. Other thoughts? Yes.
When's the School of Life coming here?
When's the School of Life coming here? Soon, I hope. Soon, I hope. We hope to bring it here. The School of Life is something that I started about 5 years ago. Broadly speaking, I started it because I thought that so many things that we need to learn are just seen as lying outside of education. And I had too many conversations with people who'd say things like, you can't learn that. That's just something that, you know, you just pick up. And you go, really? Is there no shortcut here? Are you sure? I have to actually go through 9 divorces and get the wrong job, etc. Is there nothing that one human being can tell another? Maybe if you have a nice grandmother, they might tell you. Well, it's to replace grandmothers, because grandmothers are in short supply, and sometimes they don't get around to telling us what they should. And I think there is a lot of transgenerational wisdom, and the School of Life is an institution designed to try and capture that. Until we come here, we're trying to come here. Until we come here, watch us on YouTube. We have a lively YouTube channel. Some of you here might be from there. And thank you. And the digital space allows us to be a little bit everywhere. And we want to come back in three-dimensional form as well. So watch this space. Other thoughts?
You raised the very good question of where do we get our ideas of romantic love, something we don't normally think of, and identified the source in terms of history. This went off. There we go. And so on. But in a sense, that begs the question, given that the current notion of romantic love isn't natural, it isn't historical, where did the romantic writers and the TV writers and the movie writers, where did they get it from? In other words, what's its original source?
I think the transmission of ideas is fascinating because we sometimes look for a very linear thing, like one person said this and then they influenced the whole century. But the climate of ideas is formed by many, many different actors. And together there are movements. But I think, you know, without being able to pinpoint it on just one person or a set of people, although, you know, with Romanticism, you really can, to an astonishing degree, pinpoint certain developments to a group of writers, artists, and theorists who were alive in essentially a 50-year band, who will now still influence how a young man and woman in Philadelphia today are dating can literally be traced back to some certain things that Keats would have said way back when. And it's bizarre because the boy and the girl haven't read Keats. So that's kind of odd because, like, how can you be influenced by someone you've never read? But you can be. You know, these things are in the air. And I think the way of liberating ourselves is partly to become aware of the ideas which we have imbibed without quite questioning their origins. What we call common sense is often riddled with all sorts of errors, and the work of intellectual life is to become self-aware and therefore to audit your ideas more forcefully and see which ones you might actually want to give up and which ones you could properly and honestly keep clinging to.
Aside from this novel, which other novels or films or other works would be aligned with this type
of thinking? Such a good question. I tell you a film that I saw recently and loved is a film by Richard Linklater called Before Midnight. And it's part of the trilogy of films that he made, which started with Before Sunrise. Before Sunrise is a classic romantic novel. Before Midnight is a much better movie, much more honest, much more useful movie. It contains the longest argument I've ever seen in cinema. It contains a bitter argument that lasts literally, because I timed it, 22 minutes. 22 minutes of a couple basically spilling out their fury with one another. They love one another deeply, but they are so hurt, they're so fed up, they're so angry, and they just go for it. And It's strange seeing that in cinema, partly because, well, cinema, as we know, does not properly hold up a mirror to the reality of our lives. We need art because we can't be honest about who we are. The reality of who we are, despite all our social media, et cetera, we are still routinely and constantly, not just on Instagram, lying about who we are. The reality of who we are doesn't get out. It doesn't get out among friends. It doesn't get out among social media. And for me, art, good art, is the place where you can meet the real truth about what it is to be human without varnish. And it, I mean, there's lots of stuff called art, which for me doesn't pass that criteria because it's still selling you essentially a kind of sentimentalized version. But great art, in great art, I think you feel that the artist knows you better than you know yourself, has put a finger on a dynamic which is yours, is fundamentally yours, but with a clarity and an honesty of which you were not consistently capable. And then that's when art becomes overwhelming and the most important thing in the world, and you think, wow, that's it, that's why it exists. But you don't get that moment often. Like love, it's rare. You know, I think it might be one movie every 5 years that actually does that to you properly. But that movie by Richard Linklater is absolutely one of them.
So you were talking before. You mentioned self-editing yourself, sort of lying a little bit in order to make that relationship work. And I was reminded of it. I don't know. It seems like something people experience, a sort of pang of a pain or hurt almost when you're not like true to yourself, when you do something that doesn't feel honest to who you are. So do you see that sort of self-editing or lying almost as a necessary compromise of your own individuality, if that makes sense?
Sadly, yes. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I think what you're saying is that feels painful and sad. And I agree it is. But I don't, for that matter, think that it's necessarily always wrong because it's done in the name of something. I mean, the moment when I fully understood it was around children. I've got children now. And being a parent is all about editing. You do not want to expose. Because when you have a child, you think, I love this person more than anything. And you also realize, because I love them more than anything, I don't want to show them more than a fraction of who I really am. Not in order to deceive them and lie to them, but in order not to hurt them. Because there's so much about me that I'm disturbed. You know, there's a bit disturbed. So, you know, we edit ourselves. This happens a lot, you know, around sexuality, but it happens around all aspects of the self. So it's a melancholy. I'm a great believer in melancholy moods. Melancholy moods are moods when you realize that you're dealing with one of the great incompatibilities of life, or one of the great unsolvable problems of life, death, the pains of love, the difficulties of work, etc. They don't need to elicit, you know, raging misery, but they can often elicit a mood of tender melancholy where we think, you know, it's tough, this business of being alive. And that's a mood that melancholy is not a very American emotion. It's kind of, you kind of go like, I'm feeling kind of melancholy. What, really? That's pretty un-American, really. But I think it's one of the, there are not many advantages to living in the UK, but one of the advantages is that, you know, we do melancholy well. And there needs to be room for it, I think, in the individual soul. I think we need it. Take some of the pressure off us.
So dealing with kids, sometimes they are very difficult and unsolvable. And they can't communicate with the way that we can. And I think that sometimes we're just like kids. We can't communicate what we're feeling as well. How do we work through a relationship? And how do we work through that to help the person discover?
That's such a good question. I think you start with the idea that it's very difficult, that it's not normal, that you're absolutely right. We live, you know, we're almost made biologically to live in a kind of forward direction where we don't look backwards, we don't look inwards, we don't place much emphasis on communication. These were not priorities among our earliest ancestors. It doesn't come necessarily naturally to us. So to accept that we're trying to do something kind of artificial, like landing a plane or performing a surgical operation, but that's nevertheless very important, which is trying to tell another person, trying to, first of all, get in touch with our own feelings and then convey those feelings to another person. It's bizarrely hard to get in touch with your own feelings. Why is it so hard? Partly because our feelings flit through consciousness so quickly, leaving almost no trace, so that somebody will go, you know, our partner may say something like, oh, you know, John got a promotion the other day, and you don't even notice, but you're actually upset. That's kind of really annoying news. What? Really? But you don't recognize it, but you're kind of in a bad mood. But you don't know why you're in a bad mood, but you do notice that the chair is broken at the end of the table. And you go, you still haven't fixed that chair. You're really not looking after the house very well. And the other person goes, no, I am looking after the house. I'm doing quite a good job, I think. Why are you always bringing me down? No, I'm not bringing you down. And suddenly, the original catalyst of the upset has been lost. And it would require, you know, unbelievable forensic sensitivity to go, oh, hang on a minute, it wasn't that, it's not the chair. The chair is a cover for this other thing. And I think it also requires a modesty about how peculiar we are, that the things that set us off are ostensibly so small. And so it really helps, again, to have art and culture in the background that legitimates this kind of work and makes it seem like part of something that we've all got to do. Because the more we think, oh, yeah, that's kind of, you know, a little bit of self-analysis, that's a good thing to do, then the more we'll feel less peculiar for needing and wanting to do it.
What did you enjoy most about creating the exhibit at the Rijksmuseum for Artist Therapy?
So I made a museum show in Amsterdam a few years ago. Look, what I enjoyed the most was telling people that art could be something that they engaged with in a really personal way. Because one of the questions that I'm obsessed by is, what is art for? And clever elite people just tend to assume that art is just great and obviously important. It's obviously important to read Proust, obviously important to read Dostoevsky and to like Monet, etc. And I've got this little side of my brain that goes, why? Why? We need to kind of explain it. And I want art to be useful. I've always had this desire not to simply study art and love art for its own sake, but because it does stuff, because I've noticed it doing stuff for me sometimes. And that's what I think that, you know, the point of art should be explained, I think, quite clearly. And the people who guard art in universities and museums are often kind of reluctant to say what it's really about. And so I wrote a book called Artist Therapy. The museum show followed on from that, which just tried to unpick what it was, what it is about works of art that makes them important. I just give you one tiny example. I studied what's the most bought postcard in the world, and the most bought postcard is one by Monet it's a painting that hangs in the Met in New York, and it's a really hopeful scene, a beautiful garden in springtime. And clever people get really worried when people buy that sort of postcard and pin it to the fridge, and they go, don't people know that life's really full of pain and there's Syria and disasters and Trump and... Oh, I promised not to mention Trump anywhere on my trip. Politics. And then really what I think a lot of art is bottled hope. It's hope that's been collected and stabilized, because many of our moods internally pass very quickly. And often you want a work of art to stabilize a mood that's valuable but fragile in yourself. You find an external form of it and you pin it to the fridge, because really what you're saying is, I'd like to be more like that thing, more reliably like that thing. So that's a little theory on art. One last question, which is going to go to my uncle. I have an uncle in the audience, Uncle Claude, who lives in Philadelphia. Claude, you're on. Tell us your question. And a hand for my Uncle Claude.
I'm fascinated by you every time I hear you speak.
This is what you need family for.
No.
He's gonna say what I was like as a quiet child who didn't speak. Look, he's written books. He's on a podium. No, right. I tease.
We're very proud.
What
of
is
you.
Your question,
so
Uncle Claude?
So the biggest question I have, you've written the book about love. Has it helped you at home being more romantic?
Has it helped me at home? Good question. You know, I've got a wonderful wife, and part of the reason she's wonderful is she's incredibly dark. So at least once a day, she goes, look, do you want to divorce me? How's it going? Should we end this, or how's the experiment going? On our anniversary, our 10-year anniversary, she was like, okay, surely tonight we're going to, you know, end it all. And I love that. It's very relaxing. It's a good sort of starting point. So we like to tease each other. And when I said I've written a book about marriage, she went, uh-oh. And she said, look, she really liked the book, actually. And she normally doesn't like what I wrote, but she really liked it. I think because she recognized that I'm on the side of love, that I'm on the side of trying to make relationships stronger. The novel is a story of two people. Just to do a little sales pitch, the novel is a story of two people who start out as fervent romantics. They love each other, but they haven't got the first clue how to make a relationship work. And it follows them over time, over the years, and shows the patient and slow way with which through which they come to understand what it means to properly love one another. And so my wife was keen on that. She liked that. And she said, go on. But what she really hates, unfortunately, is people keep coming up to her going, so what do you think about the book? That she doesn't hate and that she doesn't like at all. And she has various answers depending on the audience, including, that's it, I'm leaving him after this book, or I can't leave him. Can you imagine my distress? I've now got to stay at least a couple of years just to, you know, until the paperback. We're sticking until the paperback. Then we'll cut loose. But anyway, so that's my answer. But listen, time is running out. And what I really want to say, I'm on an American book tour going all around your beautiful country. I was in New York last night, Philadelphia tonight. Such a pleasure, such an honor. So nice to meet all of you. Thank you for coming. I'll be signing upstairs. And I wish you so much luck in life and not least, of course, in love. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.